I'm recording now.
So am I.
Oh, God, we've been over this. Welcome to the MacGuffin Man. I'm Alex.
I'm James.
He's quick on the gun there. He didn't even let me say his name this time.
It's James.
Yeah, okay, thanks. Just before we get started with our episode, we want you to check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We have a lot of other audio and video podcasts up there. Last week, we put out audio podcasts on The Gray, and a video podcast on Drive, the Ryan Gosling movie from last year, The Gray being the Liam Neeson movie from earlier this year, where instead of throat-striking humans, he punches wolves. And
in the face.
Yeah, right in the face.
In the wolf face.
Yes, not in their aardvark face. But yeah, and we've got a lot of other content. We do a lot of writing, a lot of pop culture criticism out there as well. And be sure to follow us on Twitter as well, at the MacGuffin Man, all one word, and MacGuffin with an M-A-C. And also, if you subscribe to us on iTunes, which you should if you use iTunes, if you could go and give us a review, that would be amazing. We like it when people hear that we exist, and reviews help that to happen. So basically any way you can spread the word that this is a podcast you enjoy listening to and watching when it's a video episode, any of those things are very much appreciated. We need your help, and that's about it. So now that we're done begging, let's start the episode.
Get up off our knees and record a podcast.
Welcome to the MacGuffin Men. This episode is brought to you by forget it, it's Chinatown. And now here are Alex and James.
So yeah, what are we talking about today, James?
A movie.
Oh, okay. that was a twist.
Not an M. Night Shyamalan movie.
No.
Chinatown.
Yeah.
Yeah, you sound excited.
I'm very excited. I watched.
Do you like?
What?
Do you like this movie that much?
I like this movie a lot.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. Do you not?
It's one of those movies that, when I think about it, it seems like I should like it more.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I like a lot of the pieces to it. And I'm not just saying that because it gets a lot of critical love, because it certainly gets that.
Mm-hmm.
Especially for the screenplay, it's kind of one of those templates that people work off of. Like, this is widely regarded as one of the best screenplays ever. And, is taught in screenwriting classes and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, makes the list of best movies, and it kind of came out of that time in the mid-70s that a lot of people really look back on and say this was a time when people were, you know, making movies the way they wanted to. And it gets a lot of critical appreciation, and that's not why I want to like it.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw this movie a few times before. I rewatched it again twice for this.
Mm-hmm.
And I never really enjoy sitting through it that much. And then I think about it and I read about it, and, you know, it is a well put together movie, but I don't know, something about actually watching it, I really don't enjoy that much.
Okay. That's fair. I totally understand that.
Yeah.
The first time I watched it, I did not particularly enjoy it. But I mean, I was probably like 16 or something, so
yeah.
This seems like a movie that 16-year-old people wouldn't like as much as a 26-year-old, you know?
Yeah.
And I totally understand those complaints because of that. And also, it is kind of, I don't know, it's not fun to just sit and passively watch this movie. It is really fun to watch and spend a lot of time thinking about this movie, you know?
Yeah. And I remembered everything about watching, everything about the movie the last time I watched it, and yeah, I really, the first time I saw it, I was probably a bit older than you when you saw it the first time. It's probably 18 or 19. And yeah, I just didn't like it. I like it probably more now than I did then, but it still doesn't, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't have a great time watching it.
Okay. Well, see, like, I, again, understand that. But then today I watched it two times back to back and had no problem with that. Like, the credits finished rolling, and then the credits started rolling at the beginning again. You know, like, and I thoroughly enjoyed my day, you know?
Yeah, and it's one of those movies I don't want to scare people off it. Like, I still would recommend it somehow, because I think it's not just because it's important, because it's critically appreciated, but I don't know a lot of movies like that. And I mean, I guess they're saying it's a noir movie, which, you know, was done a lot in the 40s, 50s.
Yeah.
And it kind of has this, you know, it really does hit a lot of cliches of the genre. Well, maybe not cliches,
It's a neo-noir. It hits a lot of things and also changes things.
Yeah. And so it is interesting, especially because I didn't see a lot of movies in that genre growing up. I don't think it's something a lot of people see often now. Mm-hmm. I guess neo-noir has kind of made a bit of a comeback lately. But, there's not a lot of movies like it that are, you know, popular now.
Okay.
But, you know, it's worth a watch, and I don't know, I'm probably making it sound worse. It's not that
you
I
absolutely
hate...
are making it sound worse.
Yeah, I know. I know I am. I guess because when I read about it, and I've just been researching it so much lately, people really, really give it up for this movie.
Yeah.
And critics just kind of go nuts for it, and I'm not there.
Maybe when you're 40, we'll check back in on episode 14,000 and we'll see if see if you're more into it.
What do you like so much about it?
I just I enjoy particularly, like, there are a lot of like little things in the movie that are really great. Like things that get mentioned that seem like nothing that come back. I think those are the things where all that critical love for the screenplay specifically really comes in. Like when the photographer towards the beginning, who is spying on Noah Cross, or no, he's spying on Mulray before Hollis Mulray before he dies, and he's getting Mulray's in an argument with Noah Cross, and all this photographer can hear over the traffic is the word Applecore, and how that turns out to be Albacore, which is the country club. Yeah. And the bad for grass thing with the glasses, even something that's sort of like more obvious, like Faye Dunaway like honking, like hitting her head on the steering wheel in an earlier argument with Jack Nicholson's character.
Yeah.
Just stuff like that. Like, there's all kinds of things, like little things like that, that I really enjoy.
Yeah. And I do enjoy the time period that it's set in. It's 1930 something.
Seven. Yeah. You pronounce seven in an odd way there.
I said something.
Yeah, you were close.
Yeah, no, I do enjoy the setting and everything. And I do like the kind of detective genre.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking of little things, the one thing I think of is, Jack Nicholson's character, Jake Gittes?
Yes.
That we're going to go with?
Gittes.
Yeah. He's a private investigator throughout the movie, and is, you know, we see him work one matrimonial case right off the start, and then, or not even see him work it, but see him report his findings to somebody.
Somebody being Adrian's brother from Rocky.
Yes, true.
Okay, Burt Young.
Curly in this.
Pardon?
Curly?
Curly, yeah. totally is his name.
And then we kind of see him get involved with the case that takes up the rest of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
He's a detective, and he does a lot of cool detective things. And I talked about it a lot in the Conversation, Enemy of the State podcast, and the Bourne podcast, like all the little physical things that they do to fill to have that profession.
Yeah.
That stuff fascinates me. And we get a couple of those in this one.
The watch?
The watch under the tire, exactly what I was going to say.
That's so awesome.
I know. It's so old-timey and great, but so sneaky and 100% effective.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing, water is such a huge theme, I guess, just very recurring. Would you agree?
Yes. There is a lot of water in this film. It's discussed a lot and exists in the background a lot.
Yeah, and just exactly, just existing in the background. It's such a, you know, such a basic element, I want to say, which is absolutely correct, but not
or
the way
human
I mean
need,
it.
You know?
Yeah, exactly. But they do such a great job, as you said, of working it into the background. I mean, it's so central to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
In the way, it's kind of a MacGuffin, but in a distant way.
Mm-hmm.
But I always feel the need to mention MacGuffins whenever I get the chance to on this podcast.
As you should. Yeah.
But I mean, there's always water coolers in the background. his photographer brings him those pictures and he's still pulling it out of the water it was developed in.
Just
speaking to your point of people really love this screenplay because of the little things like that. And it's the way Robert Towne, the guy who wrote the screenplay, really just weaves in water every chance he gets, and not to the point that it's annoying or distracting, but, you know, really, yeah, just drives it home and, you know, background and subtle ways, but really just keeps it ever present. And I think that, you know, I say this a million times, but when the themes and things like that can add to that whole vision and come up over and over without it being too, you know, deliberate and forced down your throat, it really makes it seem like a very cohesive screenplay and just a cohesive film altogether. So,
yeah. And I mean, Robert Towne does get sole screenplay credit on this movie. It's sort of well documented that Roman Polanski was involved with a lot of the writing, and Jack Nicholson apparently wrote a lot of his dialogue as well, which is not to say that doesn't typically happen, but I just feel like it certainly bears mentioning here because we're talking about how well loved this screenplay is, you know.
Do you want to talk about Jack Nicholson?
I would love to. One quick thing, like, just building on what you said there. I mean, you said a lot of we mentioned a lot of sort of smaller things in this movie, but like a big thing that I love about this movie is just the way the story is told, how Jake, Jack Nicholson's character, is in every scene, and we find out Everything we find out in the movie, we find out as he finds out.
Yeah.
With the exception being the opening shot, you know, and we don't know what we're looking at when we see those pictures that Curly's flipping through, you know?
Right.
That's something that Jake already knows that we don't. Pretty much everything else in the movie that is learned, we learn with Jake. And I think that's really
cool.
Yeah,
that's true.
And he is in every scene. And Roman Polanski said that is a... sort of like a tribute to a noir writer he really liked. Really should have written that name down. But I really love that aspect of the movie. As far as if I had to pick one thing about this movie that I love the most, just as a mystery movie, one, the mystery works for me. It works so well, and there's so much going on that I actually, every time when I watch this movie, forget a twist, like a really big twist. And there's just so much going on. And I love the way that we are eventually explained these things too. Like, this movie never panders, like almost to a fault. It never over explains anything to the audience.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And
they do not care about the average viewer in this movie. And that speaks very much to the time it was released in. But I mean, you know, 1974, that's the same year as The Conversation, which we talked about a few weeks ago. And again, that wasn't a pandering movie, but this movie even further does not care about the average viewer. And I love that. But
In researching this, I always look at critical opinion, and then I try to get a grasp of contemporary opinion, like how people thought about it at the time versus how people think about it now.
Mm-hmm.
And as you said, maybe to a fault, it doesn't really spoon feed you what's happening.
Yeah.
And I see people saying, hey, I really love this movie, but what happened in it? Like, it does create this, you know, this mood that is consistent throughout the whole thing. And I think what you said about really finding out everything as Jake does, absolutely being in his shoes.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's a detective movie. It's all about things becoming clearer and clearer. And, you know, the search of this truth that is, you know, it's so far away at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
Like, because as you said, there's just so many twists. It's not, oh, who killed this person? You know, maybe in 80 minutes, oh, it'll be this person's name. Like, it's, you don't even know what you're getting into at the start of this movie.
And I love it.
The first thing is, oh, is my husband cheating on me? You think it's going to be a yes or no. And then you're 10 steps removed from that question by the time you get to the end of it, right?
I know. And then they bring it back, and you're supposed to be like, what? This person, I recognize him. Wait, he was in Rocky. Wait, Rocky hasn't been released yet. It's 1974. And just all this stuff. There's actually a quote that I found from Robert Towne that I really enjoyed. That really sort of speaks to what you just said, where he says, I think it's almost impossible to lose an audience in the first 10 minutes, but almost inevitably you lose the audience in the last part if you haven't got the groundwork laid in the film at the beginning. Which I think sort of explains part of the thinking for the beginning of Chinatown, for sure. And I think just that first part of his statement that it's really difficult to lose an audience in the first 10 minutes is entirely true. Because I'm never more interested in the average film than I am in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah,
and like, I'm willing to go wherever I need to in the first 10 minutes. And if by minute like 25, what you're saying, it still drives me crazy, then I'm just like, okay. Then I start to think, hey, you're a bad movie, probably.
Yeah, yeah, you give every movie, you know, 10 minutes of leeway, pretty much.
Yeah, except the movie 13. Did you ever see that movie? Turn that off in like 9 minutes. That was a piece
13.
Of shit.
Which one's 13?
Holly Hunt.
13 Ghosts and didn't like it.
No. It was the Evan Rachel Wood's first movie. It was about like 13-year-old girls. Holly Hunter was her mom. It was like really well-liked. It was, I think Catherine Hardwick might have made that movie. It was really well-liked at the time, but nobody remembers it, probably because it was terrible. Although I guess, I shouldn't really say that I can comment on it, given that I just said I turned it off in minute 9.
Yeah,
I made it further through her Twilight movie than I did through 13.
Not a good sign.
No.
Listen to the Twilight podcast if you have any doubt on how we feel about that movie.
Yeah.
No, I think I said it on another podcast, though, but it's a kind of a classic screenwriting tip. If you have a problem in the third act, it's because you actually have a problem in the first act.
Yep.
And this is such a testament to that. As you said, there isn't a problem in the first act, which is why when everything comes together in the third act, you are pretty invested in it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I was speaking kind of negatively about it, but I did care about the story and... Mm-hmm. They do leave you wondering, and with every twist, there is something more that you do want to learn.
Yeah.
But I guess for me, I get more caught up in wanting to know the next thing than enjoying the trip there.
Okay.
Which, I don't know. I guess the fact that I care about what's happening says it's not an awful movie, but...
Yeah, and I mean, you don't always watch the movie two times before we talk about it, so...
Yeah.
You cared more than the average movie that we talk about, so...
Yes.
That says something, you know.
Agree.
So, going back to Jack Nicholson, you want to talk about Jackie N?
Yeah, I do. This is early for him.
It's sort of looked at as the movie where Jack Nicholson... It becomes a viable leading man. You know?
Yeah. Well, and I looked at his filmography. Mm-hmm. He'd been acting for about 20 years or something.
Oh, yeah. No, he was, he was not like an overnight sensation. He's got like this really, really interesting, varied career that people our age don't always know about because of, he's just generally accepted as a crazy person who watches Laker games to people our age. You know?
Yeah. And in some of the movies he's in, I think it's, The Shining's a big part of it. I think that's a kind of an iconic role for him.
Yep.
And if you asked anybody, name three movies Jack Nicholson's in, I don't know. I think it's
The Shining and Batman are two that will always be there, I think.
Yeah. And I guess if One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest is big.
Yeah, but there's...
But it's like, not present in people's minds as much now.
Yeah, that third movie has to remain revolving because, you know, like 20-year-olds would say The Departed or something, or The Bucket List, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas somebody else might say Five Easy Pieces, you know?
Yeah. So.
Or Easy Rider. He's so awesome and un-Jack Nicholson-y in Easy Rider.
Yeah, laid back.
Yeah, I think Easy Rider was where he sort of started to become Jack Nicholson, you know? Like he was on his... starts building to what became Chinatown, where... after Chinatown, he's sort of this viable leading man, which is what leads to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which was this big populist hit.
Yeah, so. And he's not crazy in this one at all.
No. He always looks kind of crazy. Like, just the makeup of his face.
Yeah.
Just the angles of his face are just really sharp and pointy. That is kind of what contributes to him just seeming crazy at all times. Even in his old age, like, I mean, as his face has sort of, like, softened and all, you know, gotten saggier and stuff, he's still... I mean, even without that hair and those sunglasses, he would still look kind of crazy.
Yeah.
There's just something about his eyebrows. I don't trust those eyebrows.
The only time you see him get kind of crazy in this movie, at least that I can remember, is when he's telling the joke.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Which is a good moment. And I really like Jack Nicholson in this one.
Oh, I think he's really good.
And he's not off his rocker or anything, but...
He's a little flashy. He's got a little panache to him, for sure.
Yeah, he's got an arrogance to him.
Yeah.
Everyone just, especially early on, they're calling him out on, especially in the scene when he's getting his haircut.
Mm-hmm.
they're kind of calling him out as someone who wants the spotlight and, you know, is, as you said, flashier than maybe he needs to be or other people want him to be.
Yeah.
But he's tame.
Yeah, no, I mean, compared to the Jack, again, compared to the general image that people have of Jack Nicholson now, very tame.
Yeah.
Just a quick point, since I was looking at Jack Nicholson's career credits, 1 year after Chinatown, he was in Tommy, the Who movie.
Yep.
Which, that is very funny to me. I had no idea about that.
So is it just the craziness that's the Jack Nicholson appeal? Because he's kind of a living legend at this point.
Oh, he's definitely a living legend. And a lot of times, legends, if they stay around like in the public eye for long enough or do notable things late enough in their career, then they get remembered for different things. Like, I mean, Faye Dunaway is a pretty good comparison, who's in Chinatown. She was also Bonnie in Bonnie and Clyde. Faye Dunaway, I looked up to see if she was still alive. She is. It's just we haven't seen her in anything, and she's sort of like off the map. She's still acting and all that, but I mean, she was in a CSI a few years ago, you know? So she's not in like super high profile things. I mean, I know CSI is a very high rated television show, but you know, she's not in movies with $100 million budgets or anything. And she was an iconic character in a very iconic film. Yeah. Whereas Jack Nicholson, his career, he's still in the public eye and he's doing things that not as many people or, you know, that some people care about. I mean, The Departed was very well liked. And so have some of his other movies as well. About Schmidt, I never saw, but I trust that was probably a pretty good movie because Alexander Payne made it. But anyways, like he's remained in the public eye and he's kind of a kook, you know, like with old age, all that cocaine sort of gotten to him. And, and yeah, it's just sort of, he looks kind of crazy and he comes off as kind of a crazy person. And the way he sits next to Lou Adler, who is that crazy looking person next to him at all those Laker games, does not help. So,
no. How do you like Faye Dunaway in this one?
She's good. I've never loved her in anything.
Me either.
I don't have a problem with her. I don't think she hurts anything I've seen her in, but I think my favorite Faye Dunaway is probably Bonnie and Clyde, but yeah.
Yeah, that's probably everybody's.
Yeah, well, I mean, people love Network, so I haven't seen it in so long that I can't really judge her performance in it. But,
okay.
Yeah. Good talk about Faye Dunaway.
Good Faye Dunaway. I don't know. I don't hate her. She just does nothing for me.
Yeah, that's fine.
I don't think she's attractive, as people say, but whatever. I'm not going to judge her acting based on that.
Okay.
This isn't the Mean Girls podcast.
Which hasn't been released yet. We're making jokes about podcasts that we haven't put out yet.
Damn it. Yeah.
We'll just call this another example of shitty viral marketing.
Okay.
Mean Girls video podcast coming at some time to be determined.
Do you want to talk about neo-noir?
Sure, I guess. Because, I mean, that is the genre this film is. But it doesn't... Okay, well, like, let's... when you watch this movie, how do you feel about the look of it? Like, I don't know, like, just the average frame in this movie. What sort of pops out to you?
It just feels old.
Does it? Okay. Now, when you say feels old, do you mean, like, 1930s old or 1970s old? Because, I mean, it was set in the 30s, but shot in the 70s.
Yeah, and... I don't know. I guess it sounds like a bad answer because it clearly is a combination of the both, but I'm going to say a combination of the both.
Okay. because one of the things I enjoy about this movie is, well, and I mean, this is going really with the neo-noir aspect that we were talking about moments ago, is that it is, I don't know, it feels like such a grand movie, just the way it's shot. And, everything's shot in wide angle lenses. And I mean, just the widescreen ratio is like a pretty wide widescreen. Like it's 235:1 or 240:1. Whereas older noir movies, like, I mean, films from the 40s and stuff were shot at like 1.33:1 or 1.1 or 1.37:1, you know? And
Academy ratio.
Pardon?
Academy ratio.
Is that what that was called?
Yeah.
Okay. And I mean, the more easier way to describe it to people like us is just the shape of a standard definition television, you know?
Yeah. Closer to a square.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yep. And I thought that was sort of, I don't know, I feel like the cinematography in Chinatown is kind of interesting that way, in that this is such, like, the scope of this movie is so huge. Like, the amount of people affected by this movie, you know, like, we only see, like, 10 people or so, but it affects all of Los Angeles, you know, or what would eventually become Los Angeles. Like, I mean, it's Los Angeles then, but, like, a more modern Los Angeles.
And it starts just even from Jake's perspective. He is a private eye. Mm-hmm. And he says very early on that most of the work he does is what he provides for Curly at the beginning. He calls it his matrimonial service.
Yeah, and we...
Which is basically, is your wife cheating on you?
Yeah, exactly.
Is your husband cheating on you? And that's how even this case that eventually expands begins. But as I said, it expands and expands and involves more and more people. It's first, it's just this couple. And then there's a third person because it was someone pretending to be part of the couple. And then it's, oh, but he works for the... You know, he works for the city and this dam company, and it just gets bigger and bigger. And yeah, as you said, eventually it's, you know, a large part of California.
yeah, exactly. And I mean, going with what I was saying about sort of this wide range of people affected by this movie is that, like, it looks like 80% of this movie is shot in with wide angle lenses, like super wide shots, and by, you know, scenes that would probably normally involve more close-ups. Like, there are not a lot of close-ups in this movie. And I thought that was super interesting. And I mean, I haven't been watching a lot of movies from the 70s. So, I mean, I'm sure it was more common back then just because you had, it was harder to do more setups, I assume, with the changes in technology now, you know? But it seems like modern film definitely uses more close-ups than Chinatown does. But I thought that was really interesting. And it sort of like kept with, keeping things in the big picture, whereas, you know, like the noir sort of touchstones, I guess, are like three character types, you know, and I don't know, I thought that was interesting. It's sort of like, it is a noir movie, I recognize all the things from the noir, but I also recognize that it's trying to be bigger than that and definitely newer, because there are, like, there's handheld camera work in this movie, which, I mean, doesn't seem jarring now, but in the 70s it certainly would have been more jarring. And
you get a zoom.
Is there a zoom? I don't remember.
Yeah, while he's canoeing.
Oh, is that when he's like using the camera lens?
Yeah, there's a zoom out.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I guess it fits in with the camera use. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's still goofy, but zooms are stupid. I heard Barry Sonnenfeld on a podcast recently called All Pans Objectively Just Boring. Like, anytime you see a camera pan, that is boring and should never happen.
What a bold statement.
And I mean, not that I'm the biggest Barry Sonnenfeld fan, but I'm getting closer and closer to just declaring all zooms off limits, unless you're shooting entirely handheld, you know? But anyways, the cinematography in Chinatown, like, it's meant to be very naturalistic, and I think, like, the handheld works, and the way we follow Jake in so many instances in this movie, but it's not sort of like this cheap, like, he's right in the middle of the screen and we're following him. It's sort of like he's part of the shot. Like, he'll be driving and we can see his eyes in the rearview mirror, and his body is the left side of the screen. We're seeing the road and the rest and all kinds of shots where he's framed on the left or the right. And there's that one shot of Faye Dunaway's character, Mrs. Mulray, when she's in the police station, I think, after her husband's body turns up. And we see, there's that open door to the left, on the left side of the frame, where we can see Jake pacing in and out.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like a way to both keep Jake in every scene, and also it's just an awesome-looking shot, you know?
And it's so a very natural shot of her experience at that moment.
Yeah. And it's also a very pretty shot. Like, I like the cinematography in this movie. It's not the most gorgeous movie I've ever seen by any means, but I like it a lot.
Yeah, and I mean, as you were saying, with the kind of the lack of close-ups, there are a couple, I'm not even going to call them action scenes, but...
Yeah.
Scenes where physical movement is important.
Yep. But still a lot of wides there.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, but even in the conversations, there are... you know, chances for these close-up shots and things like that, but
yeah, there are some definitely, like,
inside the car,
Yeah, and I mean, when Mrs. Mulray and Jake are having dinner, and also I'm sure when Jake and Noah Cross are having dinner as well, I'm sure there are close-ups in that scene. But I mean, just in general, like comparing it to the average movie, just so many wide-angle lenses. It's like a Wes Anderson ratio of wide-angle lenses, which is like all he uses.
Yeah. So would you say it's a very 70s movie?
I think like the filmmaking aspects of it look 70s, you know, like I mean, of course, like film stock and just the cameras that was shot on and all that just look very 70s, but producer on this movie, Robert Evans, he's kind of a famous producer, said that when they were looking to hire Roman Polanski, he said he wanted somebody to bring a more European sensibility to the film. And I feel like that sort of comes in handy with the few jump cuts that are in the movie, and also that handheld camera work I mentioned. And just in general, sort of less of a, I don't know, more of a free-flowing aspect look at the movie, you know, like sort of the French New Wave influence. Like this isn't, you know, hardcore French New Wave, but there are elements of that incorporated here. You know?
Yeah.
This is not like studio lapdog on a leash type of thing.
No. Yeah. And I mean, that's, yeah, as you said, that's something they wanted him to bring to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Roman Polanski.
Okay.
You want to know how European he is?
Sure.
I promise it's not.
He's
going
from anywhere. Europe? Is this? Are you going to say he's from Europe?
His first name's Roman.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah. Wow. How did I not see that one coming?
I don't know. Yeah. Words.
Yep.
yeah. Well, Roman Polanski.
Yes. Director.
Love director.
Yeah.
Nose cutter extraordinaire.
Yep. True, he does cameo as the person that cuts Jack Nicholson's nose in the movie.
Yeah, kind of a, I don't know, it's not that the scene's really iconic, but just the bandage that he has to wear for the rest of the movie is very kind of entwined with Chinatown now.
Yep, definitely. Yeah.
First of all, director cameos, how do you feel?
I'm fine with it. I mean, he's not such a super recognizable face that it's not weird, you know what I mean?
Would he have been? Well, I guess he wasn't super famous then.
No, definitely not. I think like the only time I have problems with directors' cameos, I think M. Night Shyamalan's a good example of this. and I don't mean, you know, like, well, I mean, for one, M. Night Shyamalan has chosen some very, very bad roles to cameo in. Like, The Lady in the Water, it's all about, I assume you never saw that movie, right?
No, but you've explained this to me, like, not even on a podcast, not even talking about movies, just how much you hate his role as, I'm paraphrasing here, but like screenwriter Jesus or
basically,
author Jesus.
Like the whole movie is about like this apartment building. From what I remember, I haven't seen it since it was in theaters because why? But, but Bryce Dallas Howard, who is the lady in the water, she is there to protect this, this writer who will write something that will change the world. And then when we get the reveal, that writer is played by M. Night Shyamalan, who wrote and directed the movie that this is happening. Like,
That's pretty bad.
I was dumbfounded when that happened. Like, I was only 18, so I wasn't as angry as I would be if it was now. But, like, I was, like, I said to my friend, for real? And and also that was one of my favorite times in movie theater, though, because everybody took that movie for what it was, which was terrible, and everyone was laughing. It was full theater. It was wonderful. But
laughing,
yeah, no,
or groaning.
Yeah, exactly. But no,
screenwriter Jesus. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That was awful. But I mean, the example I was gonna mention was his cameo. I think it's in the it's in The Village. Which is not a movie I hate like other people do. But anyways, like I think the big problem is the movie isn't over and that there's going to be another twist because we haven't seen M. Night Shyamalan's cameo yet.
Yeah.
And then it comes and he is, you know, the cameo that reveals the twist. And it's like, I knew there was something else coming, you know, like if I'm expecting a director's cameo, particularly if it's late in the movie, that's, come on, don't do that. Because then you're tipping your hat to the story. Like, Quentin Tarantino is a director that acts in a lot of things. But, you know, when we see Kill Bill, we don't expect him to pop up at some point. He might. There's always that possibility because he does act. Even outside of his own movies, he used to act as well. But Yeah, it's not sort of a given that you will see him, you know, and that's where Polanski falls in. Like, his last movie, Carnage, which I liked a lot, he has a very small cameo in, but I mean, when he showed up, I didn't even know it was Roman Polanski, and I know what Roman Polanski looks like, you know?
Yeah, and it's not so pivotal as what you're describing with M. Night Shyamalan. It's like, it's me, I'm Carnage!
Exactly, and I mean, Carnage has five people in it, and one of those people is Roman Polanski. You know, like, this is it's a four-person movie that Roman Polanski just shows up in, and he's the only other person in it, and it's not distracting, you know? Because, well, I mean, his face is obscured and stuff, but whatever.
Yeah, no, but just the fact that it's... Yeah. Not so integral to the movie.
Exactly. Yeah.
And in this one, he does play an important part.
Yeah.
But it's not, you know, because it's early on, because it could be, you know, that could have happened to Jake in several different ways.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean,
not as painful.
And it's not like he plays the role poorly either.
So. No, I watched that whole movie and I even knew Roman Polanski was in this one, but I hadn't seen this movie in probably 5 years.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I remember that he was in it, and then I got to the end and kind of just thinking back, and it was like, oh, where was he in that? Oh, yeah, okay, right. Yeah. Sure. Yeah. But you said something interesting before, that they wanted him to kind of bring that European sensibility to it.
Yeah. Robert Evans said he thought that the movie might be a bit more cynical that way, just because, I don't know, although I feel like it's not hard to find a... you know, American hating American, but I mean, it's probably easier to find a non-American that hates America, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb and say this movie ends on a downbeat.
Yeah.
And isn't the feel-good movie of any year.
Let alone 1974.
Let alone 1974. But is it about hating America?
No. I think it's about, I think something telling about this movie that I found really interesting is, again, going back to the producer, Robert Evans. He initially wanted to hire Robert Town, pay him $125,000 to adapt The Great Gatsby, which Robert Town decided no, because he didn't think he could top the novel, and instead took $25,000 to write his own thing, which became Chinatown. And I think that's interesting because I feel like The Great Gatsby is very much about, you know, the darkness hidden behind the idea of the American dream. And there are some very sort of like key American things in this movie, basically just capitalism in general, and greed, and that I think exist in The Great Gatsby and also exist in this movie, but are not the same, you know? But yeah.
Okay. Well, first of all, I think I'm just reading about Roman Polanski, and I really haven't seen a lot of his movies.
Okay. I haven't seen a whole... I've probably seen like 5 or 6 of his movies.
Yeah, and he's been around... I mean, this was a big one for him, but he had been making movies for, what, a decade before this?
Yeah, yeah.
I think...
Rosemary's Baby is his first big one that Americans would know. North Americans.
And Knife in the Water, not Lady in the Water, was his big, like, that's his feature debut, right?
Yeah, it looks like it from...
Is that 64?
62.
Okay, so even more than a decade before this.
There are some things before it, but I mean, I don't know. Famous directors tend to have very extensive Wikipedia pages that might not... These things might not be features. But anyways, Knife in the Water.
I think it's Knife in the Water. Maybe it's not his feature film debut, but I think that's what kind of... That was his big arrival on the scene, at least.
Gotcha.
From my research. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like... Again, I haven't seen a lot of his movies, but just reading about it, it's a lot of... negative movies, even movies that people really appreciate about it. It's kind of dwelling on some of the more negative aspects of human nature.
Yep, that's true.
Like, you know, depression, jealousy, and sadness, and all these kinds of things.
Holocaust.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll get to that. You can see that if someone wanted this movie to be a bit more cynical or depressing, maybe, or just not overly optimistic, Roman Polanski would be a good person for that.
Yeah. And I mean, this is sort of part of that. I mean, this is comparatively early on in his filmography. But yeah, no, I think that's definitely a part of it. And yeah, I can definitely see how Robert Evans would be like, yeah, this is the right guy for this sort of kind of cynical movie. And I mean, Polanski, apparently the ending was Polanski's idea. And so he certainly brought some cynicism to the movie in that it ended happier before Roman Polanski was attached to it. So,
yeah. Well, do you want to talk about kind of Roman Polanski's life? And I mean, it's dangerous territory to try to psychoanalyze someone just from the work that they've made, but
I haven't seen enough of his work to really offer like sort of an auteur look. And I mean, the things I've seen of his aren't even the most famous. Like, I've never seen Rosemary's Baby, which is one of his most famous movies. Like, I've seen Oliver Twist, which sucked and nobody saw. and The Pianist, people know that. And I didn't love it, but there are sections of it that are really great. I don't feel like I am qualified to judge his career, really.
Do you want to talk about the life he's lived and see how that might inform? I mean, even without seeing a lot of his movies,
yeah,
well, I'm aware of, you know, what he brings to the table. And even what, was it Robert Evans you were saying wanted him to bring that cynicism to it?
Yeah, well, his
even that, even early on in his career, I mean, this was 74, which this movie was released in 74, which means when they were choosing a director for it, we're obviously before 74, probably by 1 or 2 years.
Yep.
So kind of this negative, cynical tint that he would be bringing to these films that they wanted him to bring, Chinatown in particular, came from somewhere.
Yes. Well, I guess the most obvious thing that you're referring to is how his second wife, Sharon Tate, was murdered by, Charles Manson's quote-unquote family while she was pregnant, you know, and this is a couple years before Chinatown. And, and I can see still being kind of angry about that 5 years after the fact. And I think Polanski was not, you know, exactly excited to make this movie and have to come back to America because he left America after this. And he was sort of wary about coming back to America just because, you know, such a horrible thing happened to his family while he was there, you know?
Yeah, just so. Negative memories.
Yeah. Yes, the most negative
memories. Well, yeah, I have a quote here from his autobiography. Uh-huh. And as he said, his wife was Sharon Tate, was an actress. He said, Sharon's death is the only watershed moment in my life that really matters. And he goes on to say that her murder changed his personality from a boundless, untroubled sea of expectations and optimism to one of ingrained pessimism and eternal dissatisfaction with life.
Yep. That pretty much covers what you were getting at for sure, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, this is someone who, like, that shows such a steep decline. I mean, he says he used to be a boundless, untroubled sea of expectations and optimism and went to having ingrained pessimism and eternal dissatisfaction with life. Mm-hmm. This is someone who grew up in Poland in the late 1930s.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Who's one of his parents literally died in Auschwitz, and he saw his other parent be marched away by Nazis. And when he approached that parent to see what was happening, the last thing that parent said to him was get lost, like just to try to, you know, save that child from going through the same thing that the parent was about to go through. And to survive that and still have what he said was boundless, untroubled sea of expectations and optimism, like that's just such a testament to how much that really affected him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and absolutely.
Just reading kind of excerpts from his autobiography, cinema and film meant so much to him in his early life, you know, before and after, you know, these horrible things I just described. And yeah, for this thing to affect him that much, you know, I don't mean it in a critical way at all, but it's kind of amazing that he was still that optimistic about human nature up until this happened. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, to me, it's just amazing because I don't know, like, I had my bike stolen when I was 11. That's the worst thing I have in my childhood, you know? Yeah. Like, just for something to turn you that much after what he'd been through, it's just kind of amazing that he was still that optimistic at that point in his life.
Yeah, no, that's
so
true.
There is that cynicism about it, and, you know, it's obvious where it comes from. But he came up in Europe. I mean, he lived in Poland and moved around a bit after that. Yeah. But people call him one of the few, like, truly international filmmakers.
Okay.
And people, I mean, movies get dubbed and things like that, but he makes movies in, you know, different languages and using actors and actresses from all different countries and things like that. And
okay.
I don't know. It's just interesting. I think Chinatown is, you know, it's an important American film. Mm-hmm. And it's,
absolutely.
I think it's very American.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And I think it's interesting that, you know, this person that is so international, you know, really drives this Americana home in a way. And it's not the Americana that people like or people praise, but it's a very important strand of it at the same time.
Yep. I and concur. Yet,
okay. There's always that point. And yeah, that's just the bummer ending of it, I guess, of Chinatown that I think they wanted for this movie. And, you know, absolutely, it builds and builds and builds and things become clearer and clearer. And as you said, you know, we're in this guy's shoes. It's a detective movie and it's about chasing down this mystery. And when we get kind of an understanding of the movie, of what's been going on this whole time, and things suddenly become clear, you kind of want that positive resolution, and there's supposed to be a sense of relief in finally understanding the reality of what you've been trying to figure out for an hour and 45 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't get that satisfaction. Even when we understand everything, it brings us down right at the end because of, you know, the nature of the reveal. And,
and yeah, just a lot of, you know, depression, depressing things happening at the end.
Yeah, and I mean, the most iconic line of this movie is, forget about it, Jake, it's Chinatown.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, I mean, Chinatown, it's, we get, two conversations about Chinatown in this whole movie?
There are a couple other mentions, I think. Like, he definitely talks about it when he's in bed with Mrs. Mulray. Talk about it at the end, and he talks about it with cops, and like there's, you know, mentions of it throughout. Like, it's fairly present throughout the movie, but I mean, these mentions of Chinatown would not be notable to the first time viewer if it wasn't the name of the movie. So you sort of feel like it's gonna come around, which it does, obviously. But it's not like Chinatown is a big part of the first 2 hours of this movie. It's only you know, we get mentions of it in the first 2 hours, and then the last 10 minutes happens in Chinatown.
Yeah. So. And yeah, as you said, the conversation with Mrs. Mulray, we get the sense that it's a sensitive subject for him.
Yeah, yeah. No, exactly. He sort of got some sort of regret for it. It's sort of because he used to be a cop in Chinatown, and he sort of moved on. He became a private detective. And it's a place that's sort of mentioned, but that nobody seems to really care about in the movie. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I don't know. I feel like I can see a lot of meanings for Chinatown in Chinatown, or at least two specific ones for sure.
Okay. Well, what's your take on it? Because it's the most important line, and it's, I don't know. I think the iconic line of movies, we usually get an understanding of what it means.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we often get the setup and then the important line kind of drives it home or puts it more succinctly than the rest of the movie has. But yeah. I think there's a lot of ways to look at that. Oh, maybe not a lot of ways to look at that, but it's at least it's not spelt out extremely
Absolutely.
Clearly.
Yeah, exactly. And I think that's one of the things I really love about this movie. And I think sort of explains, you know, your hesitance to say that you love this movie. I mean, you know, not that I'm saying the reason you don't love this movie is because you're hesitant to say I love Chinatown, but like,
No, I know what you mean.
It's because, like, all of the things that then make the movie super interesting happen in the last 10 minutes. And then, you know, you're focusing on that while it happens. And then there's no downtime. The movie just ends. And then you think about it. You know, like, the most interesting things in this movie happen at the very end. And then you sort of relate it to what happened before. That's all of what the structure of the movie is. Because we're learning things with Jake. But anyways, like, I think Chinatown's really interesting because it's referred to as this place that none of the characters that we spend a lot of time with are from. All of the servants, the gardeners, all of those people that, you know, barely have speaking roles, then that just serve people like Noah Cross and, you know, and they all live in Chinatown, but we don't care about them. So we never follow them there. And I think it's just sort of this really, this interesting way of drawing a line between the rich and the poor. Because, I mean, even Jake dresses very extravagantly. Like he yep. has more money by quite a bit than the average person. And I think that's sort of this, it's sort of the idea is that the rich people, specifically like Noah Cross and everybody that's in on this this game with him, is that they just don't care about the people in Chinatown. They're trying to build their own city to make more money. And that's why when Jake says, "How much money are you worth?" and Noah says something like, "Oh, I don't know. How much do you want?" You know, like that. Yeah. He talks about his own money very flippantly. And then Jake says, "Are you worth 10 million?" And keep in mind, this is, I mean, in 2012, that's a lot of money, but in 1937, I don't know. That's like, that's yeah. multiple countries' GDP. You know?
I was just thinking in 1974, 10 million is such a huge amount. And yeah. that's just when this movie was made, yeah. let alone think of in the 1937. Right?
Exactly. Subtract 40 years from that.
yeah.
And yeah, it's just sort of like he's just this, he's so rich, but he wants more. And that's what I said, sort of relating it to The Great Gatsby and the idea of greed. And it's just sort of Chinatown is the place where they're basically ignoring, because it's the people in Chinatown that they're ignoring and that won't benefit from this really, because they are kind of lying to the average citizen, well, by doing this whole irrigation scheme. But
yeah,
so, you know, the people of Chinatown, which I think can sort of fit in for, you know, the city, like this takes place in Los Angeles, but people aren't living in the city proper, you know,
yeah.
Particularly the evil characters, namely Noah, you know, and yeah. And I think that's kind of interesting and shows a real division between the rich and the poor. Yeah. I don't know. I mean,
I know what you mean.
Yeah. And I mean, like, there's another small moment, like when Curly's wife opens the door to his house, she's been beaten presumably by Curly because she was cheating on him, right?
Because of what Jake found out.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And there's no mention of it. Jake looks at her for a second, you know, but there's no mention because it doesn't matter because they're poor. Forget it, Jake. It's Chinatown. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, and that's absolutely, it's his, you know, it's obviously her. Okay, this is going to sound bad. It's her fault. And I don't mean, you know,
yeah, no, if, yeah.
I do not support beating anybody who cheats on you. Like, that's not what I'm getting at, but it's a result of her actions. But Jake is very much a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, absolutely. He was the one who revealed it, gave all this information to Curly, didn't care what he did with that information. But Jake got paid. He took the picture. He took the pictures. He passed the information on. He got paid. But what happened, he doesn't care. And he talks about that very explicitly. What, you know, what people do with the information he provides has nothing to do with him.
Mm-hmm.
That's beyond his, you know, purview. He doesn't care about that. And yeah, as you said, that's Chinatown. You know, this woman gets beat, that's fine. I was a part of this, but I didn't hit her, whatever. That's, you know, it's not my issue.
Yeah.
He doesn't care about that. He got his money, you know, leave everything alone. And that's Chinatown. It's
yep.
what, it's all the externalities of once your money gets made, there might be all these negative effects, but I've been paid.
Yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, exactly. And another thing I saw in Chinatown, and I mean, this makes it very important that, actually, I'll wait for a second for that. But another thing that sort of leads into that sort of mistrust of the rich and trusting people in power. Again, 1974, this is pretty soon after Watergate. And also, this movie could just as easily be called Watergate. but, you
Forget
know, it's
it,
just...
Jake. It's Watergate.
Pardon?
Forget it, Jake. It's Watergate.
No, I was sort of thinking, like, you know, you love when scandals or whatever just have gate thrown on them at the end, like Nipplegate or Shuttlegate in the Olympics, you know, with
yes.
the badminton.
Yes.
And then this is literally about water, and it's a controversy about water. So, and it's even a gate for water that they're talking about.
Exactly.
So it's just the most...
They are letting water out through a gate at night.
Yeah. This is even more of a Watergate scandal
This is a more literal Watergate scandal than Watergate.
I was thinking about that earlier today, and I was just having a nice little laugh by myself. But yeah.
Knowing how much I love titles and words.
But yeah, no, I feel like that was pretty funny, and certain even more of a Watergate scandal than the scandal that actually happened in the Watergate Hotel.
You out-Watergated Watergate.
Touche, Polanski, says Richard Nixon. Yeah, exactly. Okay, but anyways, the other thing I was thinking of for Chinatown, and again, it's very important that this movie takes place in L.A. for this one. I mean, it's important for the fact that, you know, that's valley and city set up, but also just sort of the proximity for Hollywood. And this is far less important to the actual movie, but it's sort of like the people in the city, you know, in Chinatown are sort of, you know, trying to become rich and famous. They're trying to become Jake and Cross and Noah Cross. And Jake, I mean, early on in the movie, his name is on the front page of the newspaper, you know, like, it's never totally explained why his name would be on the front page. Like, it's, I don't know. It seemed kind of weird and thrown in.
Well, he broke the story, but yeah, that always seemed kind of tangential to me, and just as a setup for that barbershop scene.
Yeah. And also I think that's where I sort of get this feeling, or this feeling that maybe there's sort of more of a, I don't know, more, it sort of ties into Hollywood a little bit, in that these people want, you know, it becomes more metaphorical. These people want the money and fame that Noah Cross and Jake have. And we see that in Ida, who plays the fake Mrs. Mulray early on in the movie. She's played by Diane Ladd. When she dies and Jake is going through her wallet, she has a Screen Actors Guild membership card in her wallet. And it's sort of like she's representative of a poor person, but she's trying to become the rich person and get the fame that comes with it. And I thought that was interesting. I mean, it's a pretty small thing. I don't feel like this movie is an allegory for the studio system or anything, you know. But
it's a good point. And she is, is she a prostitute? Is that what we're supposed to take?
Yeah,
from
she says she's a working girl. Which is sort of like, you know, I'm. Which once we see the Screen Actors Guild card, it's sort of like, well, she's doing that because she wants to be this, you know?
Yeah, but she's a prostitute, but we meet her as Miss Mulray.
Yep. And she is acting.
She's acting. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. She's pretending to be someone that she's not.
Yeah.
Somebody hired her to take on this personality that's not really hers, and, you know, recite these lines that she's been told.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, no, it's based on the story of that, you know, that is a real part of California's past about this water scandal. But yeah. No, you're absolutely right. It's very much tied into Hollywood.
Yeah, and I mean, they change a lot of, you know, of course, they bend the story of, you know, this isn't a docudrama by any means. They change a lot of things. Even just the date is different, I think. And but yeah, no, I think it's really interesting for both sides of that, like the Hollywood aspect and the just the water aspect as well.
Right on.
Hmm. Can we, one thing I forgot to mention about the neo-noir is just John Huston's appearance in the movie. John Huston, director of possibly the most famous noir film, which is The Maltese Falcon, and just sort of adding him in is sort of like a new touch to the that wouldn't happen in the 40s, you know, like it wouldn't be like, you wouldn't be nodding to the audience like that. And I thought that was kind of interesting, and also his voice is awesome.
Meta.
Yeah, well, yes, meta. And
voices so much.
His voice is great. He's got like a James Coburn voice, man.
I know, but the way that I love titles, you love voices.
Yeah, no, that's fine. That's I can only hope to ingest enough hard liquor at some point in my life that I sound like one of these guys when I'm old. Can only hope. Also, just
set your goals high, man.
Well, I'm playing the long game, you know?
Shoot for the moon. Still end up sounding like the stars.
John Huston, when he gets shot, also is hilarious to me. When he gets shot in the arm, it's just like, after standing there for a second. I found that particularly funny.
Yeah, on that subject, I love how greasy Roman Polanski is as the little henchman.
Yeah, yeah. He's so tiny and wienery.
And cutting someone's nose like that?
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah. Which is an impressive scene. I still don't know how they did that. I'm sure, I know it's been explained, but I've never seen an explanation for it, and I kind of don't want to find it because I like the mystery.
Oh, okay. You don't want me to ruin it then?
Oh, then ruin it.
Actually, no, I'll explain it without even ruining it, actually.
Okay.
Jack Nicholson and Roman Polanski, according to what I've read, had been asked about how they did that so many times.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a while they explained it, and I won't explain it for you now because you don't want to know.
You should tell the listeners though. So
okay, fine. So it is
la 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 la. No, I'm just kidding. Keep going.
We should do a whole podcast of things you don't want to hear. And you can do that for it.
Just me singing various lullabies and stuff in the background.
No, and I didn't get too in-depth into it. But apparently it's a knife. It's a real knife on a hinge that has to be handled in such a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
Like it is. It actually kind of was a pretty dangerous stunt. But mm-hmm. it had just been practiced so many times. So it's a switchblade on a hinge that when you apply pressure in a certain way, it bends back. And mm-hmm. they just slide it. They flick it forward really quickly that you don't notice.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's just a kind of a very simple trick knife, but
how did they do the blood then?
Maybe a squib, maybe blood on the knife. I don't know. I, okay. Again, I didn't get the whole details.
Okay. Cause that knife part makes sense. And I feel like that's kind of the guess I would have come up with if on a trivia show or something. It's the blood that's very confusing to me.
Yeah. And it looks really good.
Oh, it looks awesome.
Like it's. I don't like seeing stuff like that, but it's very effective.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
A visual effect.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about it for a couple minutes of, like, we still don't really know how they did it, you know? And this movie came out in 1974.
Yeah. And so, but apparently they'd been asked about it so many times and just got sick of it that they eventually just said, they agreed to start saying it was real.
Mm.
And that Roman Polanski actually cut Jack Nicholson's notice for the movie.
I like that.
Yeah, I really like that a lot, actually. Yeah, but no, that looks really good and is at that point. And yeah, just one of those little things that looks very good. And another thing that I meant to mention about when we were talking about putting the watch under the tire and all those little like detective tricks, when he takes the business card from the office.
Yeah. Great.
And, you know, and then uses that name and then like just building and building in the same way that things, you know, get revealed to us throughout this movie. He kind of builds on the little bit of knowledge he gains from every, you know, conversation that he has.
Absolutely.
And yeah, that's something that absolutely puts you in his shoes and really feels like you're, you know, learning along with this and gets, you know, puts the viewer deeper and deeper into the story.
Yeah, I do love how when he goes to get those business cards, the guy just instantly is like, yes, yes. Take them, whatever. And turns his back and leaves the room. You know, like, have your way with this room. You know, like, and I feel like it happens with the secretary right before that, too, when he's just like, oh, I'm just going to go in his office then. And yeah. He's got like a full 2 minutes in there.
In opening drawers.
Yeah. But I still like that moment. I just thought it was kind of like, why? Why would you trust this person who's just walking in offices? Because he wears a suit.
Yep.
So, I saw somebody at a quick tangential or quick point. At a Halloween party last winter or, you know, last fall, I saw somebody dressed as Jake from Chinatown, nose bandage and all. And I was so pleased.
Nice.
It was great. Yeah. So whoever you are, I met you and don't remember your name, but you did a great job.
I assume you're listening.
Yeah.
I assume all people are listening.
I assume you remember my name as well as you remember, or I remembered yours.
I put my business card in your trick-or-treat bag and wrote the MacGuffin Man on it.
I think we should probably real quick address, because I mean, we talked about Roman Polanski, his wife's murder. You know, that doesn't entirely get him off the hook for raping a 13-year-old.
No, it doesn't.
And this is something that, you know, when I've talked about this movie in the past, I mean, the most famous thing about Roman Polanski for most people is this rape case.
Yeah.
And
I think if you ask most people our age, like, name something about Roman Polanski,
mm-hmm.
it's rape, director, and then maybe something he directed.
Yeah. Cameo in the 2011 film that nobody saw called Carnage. No, it's, I mean, I certainly am not going to defend it. But it's sort of, I don't know, it's weird. And I mean, we can't sort of, we promote way too much sort of looking at the artist and their art together. And I still think like that's, you know, the person that made Chinatown had the potential to do this and then did do it, you know. I'm not, you know, looking for these things when I watch Chinatown, but the fact remains that, you know, he did do these things 3 years later, I think, at 77. Well, but it's, sorry, continue.
No, go ahead.
No, I don't, I wasn't leading in anything.
So I've been researching this whole scenario.
Mm-hmm.
And when I heard Sex Scandal and that he was charged for, you know, raping an underage girl.
Yeah.
Maybe this is me just giving someone the benefit of the doubt, but I thought, I just assumed she was like 17 or 18.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe looked a little older or lied to him or something.
Yeah.
She was 13 years old.
Yeah, no, 13's pushing it for sure. And I think he drugged her.
Pushing it?
No, sorry.
No, you know, it's pushed. It's yeah, fallen no, over. Sorry, and you know it's what never I mean. Getting back. No,
sorry, my bad. but, you know, and he drugged her as well, I think. So.
And before this, a year before, he was dating a 15 year old.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
And I mean, like, he, in general, like all of his relationships, I think, have been with people much younger than him. Like, he's currently married to somebody who's 30 plus years younger than him. So, I mean, that's acceptable, socially acceptable now because he's 73 or yeah. 78. But yeah. No,
and yeah, just all these actors coming to his defense because he's an artist or a filmmaker or involved in the same industry that they are.
Yeah.
How do you feel about that?
I don't know. Like, I don't know. I, again, you know, we've sort of discussed the whole thing in like a very broad sense. I don't know, feel like I know the details of everything. I feel like if you know a person, then it's, saying he's an artist is not a good defense, in my opinion.
No, it's really not.
He's an artist. He murdered somebody. He's an artist. It's fine. Yeah. But no, it's just sort of, you know, that's not a good enough defense. I feel like maybe if you know a person and you're like, oh, he made the, like, this terrible mistake, you know, which is like an understatement to say the least. But I don't know. It becomes different when you know the person because you're better able to justify things when you know other things about the person. Like we said, he is a film director. He has directed a movie I like a lot, but he has also raped a 13-year-old. So.
Yeah.
And it's just like,
I feel like that doesn't justify it for me.
No. But I mean, you still like Chinatown, you know, like you can enjoy Chinatown away from it. Right.
Yeah. And yeah. That's
as I can, you know?
Yeah. And that's a different issue. To come to the defense of his person is different than saying his work shouldn't be banished for it.
Yeah. No,
I mean, Wagner, the composer,
mm-hmm.
was pretty pro-Nazi,
mm-hmm.
And he was a talented composer, and I don't think those things are mutually exclusive.
Yeah.
If we want to ignore all the art created by anyone who, you know, committed a crime, then I think that's silly.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, there's kind of a revisionist history where, you know, going back to kind of the Americana thing, slavery.
Yeah.
I mean, presidents and politicians for the first, I don't know, 100 years,
mm-hmm.
really didn't have a problem with that. Benjamin Franklin enjoyed raping his slaves.
Yep.
I don't think that negates everything he ever said or did.
Mm-hmm.
No, and I think you can separate the two of them and enjoy or appreciate what somebody did beyond their morality, mm-hmm. or things like that. But what we saw with these people coming to the defense of Roman Polanski was not people saying, you know what, everybody, hey, stop hating Chinatown because he did this.
Mm-hmm.
It was, hey, let's forgive this guy and allow him to come back to America.
Okay.
And that's a separate issue entirely.
Yeah. Well, I guess it was sort of something that, because I mean, it's easier to talk about this, the Roman Polanski thing, because It's so far in the past. And I think sort of the reason I was thinking about this more with in conjunction with Chinatown is sort of the way people have reacted to Chris Brown's latest album release has been really interesting. Like, now, again, I want to preface this with I do not in any way, am not in any way okay with the fact that Chris Brown, you know, hit a woman quite, you know, intensely. But like a lot of reviews I've been reading, or I mean, I've seen specifically two, and I'm sure that's not all of them, that have just sort of been, he hit a woman, his music is invalid. And just sort of, again, not a defense of Chris Brown's actions nor his music. But it's just sort of like, I just remember the last line was no stars ever. And I was just wondering if, I don't know, I was wondering if that's just inherent, if that's inherently bad criticism, or if it needs to be said, because it felt more, it always feels like more of a soapbox at that point, you know?
Yeah, no, and I understand that, and it's tough. And what I was thinking about was, you know, from, you know, the Rihanna perspective, was people were saying like, oh, well, you're a role model. If you're gonna get back together, if you're basically telling, you know, young women, oh, guys can hit you and that's fine. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, it puts her in a tough spot. And, you know, obviously I can't speak from her perspective at all, but, you know, it can't be easy to, you know, have everybody's opinions. I'm not saying everybody looks to Rihanna for moral judgment and things like that, but, you know, there are people who do look up to her.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you know,
what she did, but it shouldn't be, you know, her place to say everything I do sets the tone for young women in the world.
Well, and very rarely does somebody, you know, nobody actually says that and then is correct about it. The people that actually set the way a lot of people act just sort of do it and are just like, well, it's not my responsibility, it's the parents. And I mean, that's sort of, that gets into the debate about, you know, being a role model and all that stuff, which I think, I'm sure Rihanna is for a lot of young girls, and probably guys as well, but like, I don't think it's her place to sort of, I don't know, make any sort of statement, particularly since just in general she's kind of an all over the map type of person. But I don't know, I just sort of was wondering about it from a more criticism standpoint. Like, do we have to judge Chinatown differently, and do we have to judge Chris Brown's music differently? And like, I mean, the songs that I've heard on Chris Brown's new record are not good, but I don't think that if I was commissioned to write a movie, or sorry, a review of his album, I could totally just sort of write about how beating women is bad. That's not what you're hiring me for. That's not music criticism.
Yeah.
So no. I don't know. It's just something interesting that I don't have an answer for.
No. Yeah, no. And you're right, because,
and like, were reviews of Roman Polanski's first movie post 1977, Tess came out in 1979. Like, were reviews, well, he looks like he got 6 Oscar nominations for the Tess. So, I guess it didn't change that much in the interim. I guess when we're sort of looking at, somebody that is commercially successful versus somebody that's critically successful, Chris Brown being extremely commercially successful and Polanski still, Chinatown, I'm sure, was a successful movie. But you know, he's remembered more from critics than the average person. You know, he's Roman Polanski, not Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, no. And I think you're right. It is a difficult issue, because when you and I, we kind of don't like to get too into what we want to discuss or exactly how we feel about movies when it comes to, you know, recording a podcast about something. But you said, well, you know, I think we both agreed, well, we have to mention this.
Yeah.
And I think there is a moral obligation to mention something big like this. And the same thing with The Dark Knight Rises. We wanted to do a podcast about it, and obviously, I mean, we wanted to do a podcast about it since The Dark Knight came out.
Yeah.
You know, there was no way we weren't going to do that. But you kind of feel like if you're going to talk about this, this is the most relevant thing, even if it's not in a critical sense, in a news sense, in a moral sense.
Yep.
It kind of needs to be brought up. And
Yeah, you're mentioning the shooting for The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, exactly.
Which we did mention in a brief sort of post on the website, not in the actual podcast.
Yeah, and that's what I mean. We knew the podcast. We were going to joke around about some things and, you know, laugh and poke fun at certain things. And I don't know. I just didn't want to do that 10 minutes after talking about something so serious.
Yeah, exactly.
And so, I think we both came to agreement that we should address it, but maybe at a different time so we can talk about the movie. We'd always talk the way we'd always talk about the movie. Mm-hmm. And we didn't want to let the actions of this person take away from what we would normally do with this movie that he had really nothing to do with.
Yeah.
But he, you know, injected himself into that story in such a way that it really needed to be addressed. And yeah. I rarely think about the moral implications of what we do when we podcast. Yeah. But with that one and with the Roman Polanski thing, it's just hard to ignore. And it's not a way to really judge art mm-hmm. and, you know, to criticize a creative project. But No, it's just something that has to be addressed.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And again, like what we said about The Dark Knight Rises, the shooting, as soon as it happened, instantly became the most relevant thing about the movie, the most, the most notable thing in society worth talking about. And I mean, like we said about Roman Polanski, his rape case is the first thing people think of. Like, you know, I've been going through Happy Endings recently. There's a Roman Polanski joke in that show, you know, and like this is a case from 1977 that is being referenced in 2012 in a sitcom, you know. So it's still the most notable thing about him. You know, they're not making Chinatown references. They're making references to this criminal case. And I guess sort of just what I'm getting at is I know we can't judge his movies entirely apart from that. We have to know that somebody with the capability to do this made a movie I like a lot, but I don't think that should necessarily, and I mean, you know, like you can get into the moral implications of people who have financed his movies afterwards. You can get into that if you want. You can say that they are bad people for sort of, you know, helping this guy continue to make films. But I think like if it exists, I think sort of just as far as criticism goes, you have to judge the movie as a movie, just like you have to judge Chris Brown's album as an album and not sort of a way to, I don't know, loudly vocalize that, of course, you are not OK with him hitting Rihanna. You know?
Yeah.
So
there's not a question about that.
Yeah. And I think a big part of the Chris Brown thing is that he's just super popular with kids and kids don't care. Kids don't understand how serious that is. But I guess, you know, didn't put a huge dent. This, the rape thing didn't put a huge dent in Roman Polanski's career either. But yeah, so.
So just like Chinatown, I think we're going to end on a bummer ending.
Nice. I was like, in that moment of silence, I was thinking, how are we going to get out of this? And you did it. You did a really good job.
Yes.
Yeah. So thank you for listening to The MacGuffin Man. Be sure to check out our website, themacguffinman.com. We have other podcasts, video podcasts, audio podcasts about all sorts of movies.
Rarely talk about rape in those.
Yeah, exactly. The vast majority of them are more like the first half of this podcast than the second half. So if you feel like we got a little dark at the end, like Chinatown, you'll be able to find something you like a little better at themacguffinman.com. So thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to The MacGuffin Men. Be sure to check out themacguffinmen.com for supplementary links, articles, and more. Thanks for listening.